Joel chapter 2 had a lengthy prophecy which seemed to portend the destruction of Jerusalem, but which had aspects to it that could not have been fulfilled at that time, that must be looking to a future day of vengeance that are parallel to what we read in Revelation chapters 18 and 19. And Joel chapter 3 seems to be a parallel again of that, the regathering of the captivity and the gathering of all the nations for judgment. So we're with another parallel prophecy in Joel chapter 3.
And Jackson, you can read like half of it if you like, and we'll do the next half after that.
Yeah, just in case.
Okay, I'll read up to verse 11. Joel chapter 3. For behold, in those days and in that time, when I shall bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the valley of Jehoshaphat and will plead with them for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land. And they have cast lots for my people and have given a boy for a harlot and sold a girl for wine that they might drink. Yeah, and what have ye to do with me, O Tyre and Zidon, and all the coast of Palestine? Will ye render me a recompense? And if ye recompense me swiftly and speed, will I return your recompense upon your own head? Because ye have taken my silver and my gold, and have carried into your temples my goodly pleasants and things. The children also of Judah and the children of Jerusalem have ye sold unto the Grecians, that ye might remove them far from their border. Behold, I will raise them out of the place whither ye have sold them, and will return your recompense upon your own head. And I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the children of Judah, and they shall sell them into Sabaeans, to all the people far off, for the Lord hath spoken it. Proclaim ye this among the Gentiles, prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near. Let them come up. Beat your own plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am strong. And then I'll stop there.
Bill, you there?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I read up to 10.
I was talking and didn't realize that I had the mic physically muted because I had to cough a few minutes ago. But this is, verse 10 is as good a place to stop as any here. That this is a promise to bring again the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem, who aren't gone into captivity yet. So this is a long-term prophecy. It's not an immediate prophecy. And even the return to Jerusalem of perhaps about 42,000 Israelites in 520 BC and the rebuilding of the Second Temple is not what that is discussing, because that was only a very small part of Judah and Jerusalem. Most of Judah was taken into Assyrian captivity already by the time that Joel had written this, and they would never return. In 520 BC, they never returned, and even the greater number of the people from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah didn't return. So only a percentage returned. They have cast lots for my people and have given a boy for a harlot and sold a girl for wine. That seems to be a judgment against the people of Judah and Jerusalem themselves, that they were partaking in those sorts of activities. But where it mentions Tyre and Sidon, those cities did not go off into Assyrian captivity. They capitulated to the Assyrians and kept themselves by paying tribute to the king of Assyria, and basically turned on their own brethren, because they were Israelites. They basically turned on their own brethren the people of Israel, of Samaria and Judah. So they also evidently had sold a lot of Israelites into slavery, as we see here in verses 5 and 6, into slavery unto the Greeks. Actually, that's the Ionian Greeks. Yavanna is the word there for Greek, and that means Ionians. So they're going to be sold in turn into the hands of the children of Judah. When that happened, I don't know. I can't say. But Tyre, the mainland city of Tyre, Tyre was a city in two portions. Tyre was destroyed by the Babylonians at the same time or around the same time that Judah was destroyed. Sidon itself, I don't remember the fate of Sidon offhand. I really don't. As a city, it lasted until Roman times, but I don't remember the fate of Sidon in Babylonian times. But I wouldn't doubt if the Babylonians didn't sack Sidon too, because Sidon was a tribute city of Tyre at the time. It was subject to the Tyrians. But even here, with these promises of regathering, that this is a far vision prophecy. It's a long-term prophecy. It's nothing that's been completely fulfilled to this day. So just like Joel chapter 2, this chapter also coincides with a lot of the revelation and the prophecies in the revelation. And the next verse you're about to read is a reference to or parallel with Revelation chapter 20 and the surrounding of the camp of the saints by all of the heathen nations. The harvest that's going to be mentioned in Joel is parallel to the harvest of the revelation.
Can you speak about the Sabians and who they are?
The Sabians, that they were from Ham. They lived in the south of Arabia, and they were robbers. And I think Sabian is probably being used here in that sense. They were robbers from the time of Job. Job was probably 800 years before Joel. Job was probably about the 14th century BC when Joel is prophesying in the 7th century BC. So at least 700 years. The Sabians were one of the raiding parties that helped destroy and loot Job when he was being judged.
But they're Adamic people?
Yes, they're from Ham, from so Sheba, same word. And the Sabians, that this is, and there came a messenger unto Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them. And the Sabians fell upon them and took them away. Yeah, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword. And only I, the one servant who's reporting to Job, am escaped alone to tell thee. So the Sabians were seen as robbers in the days of Job and here too, here also.
In verse 8, when it says the
user
Sabians
entered your channel
to people far off, do you think that that's referring to their physical location or the fact that they're far off, far from God?
Probably both. In Ezekiel chapter 23, we read in verse 42, and the voice of the multitude being at ease was with her, and with the men of common sort were brought Sabians from the wilderness. So there the Sabians are seen as being far off also. In Isaiah chapter 45, the Sabians are grouped with Egypt and Cush. And I believe that's the case in the beginning verses of Isaiah chapter 43 also. But they're not called Sabians, they're only called Seba.
Is that the same Seba, like Sheba? Or no? They're from Ethiopia?
Well, there's confusion there. I believe that the Sheba, the historical Sheba, is from Ham and not from Shem.
So when they say Sabians, it could be Sabians, right? Like it's just a matter of the vowel, or
yeah, and Sabians should be Sabians.
Okay,
it should be Sheba. I'm convinced. Even though Sheba and Sheba are mentioned together, and it's evident the Joktan's descendants inhabited Arabia, I'm persuaded, and I explained it and my reasons why in the Genesis commentary that the historical nations of Arabia, some of their names are repeated between the descendants of Ham and the much later descendants of Joktan, 1,000 years later, perhaps. And I believe that we should perceive them as belonging to the descendants of Ham and not Joktan. In fact, the prophecy in Genesis chapter 10 says Joktan will be made small, I believe, or something, or that's the meaning of his name, or yeah, that's the meaning of his name. Well, I spelled that out in my Genesis commentary on the Shemites several weeks ago.
Should I finish with the rest of the chapter now?
Sure, unless David has another question or somebody has another question.
Verse 2, this Valley of Jehoshaphat, would you kind of tie that in with like Ezekiel 38?
Yes, that's valid. And we're going to see the assembly of all nations here. In verse 11.
So like even in verse 14, we're going to touch.
What's significant so like in about verse 14, the name Jehoshaphat? I'm sorry.
I'm just because I've got a note here. Jehoshaphat means judgment.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. Yahweh is judge. That's what's significant about the name. That's all that's significant about the name here. The Valley of Jehoshaphat is where they're going to, the spot where they're going to be judged by Yahweh.
Okay, so even in verse 14 that we're getting ready to touch on, the Valley of Decision would probably be kind of one of the same thing, right?
Yeah, it's an allegory for the same thing.
Okay.
And that's a word that actually literally means sharp or sharp pointed. Okay, Jackson.
Joel 11. Assemble yourselves and come together, all ye heathen, and gather yourselves together round about. To their cause, thy mighty ones, to come down, O Yahweh. Let the heathen be weakened and come to the Valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge, and all the heathen round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come get you down, for the press is full, the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the Valley of Decision, for the day of Yahweh is near in the Valley of Decision. The sun and the moon shall be darkened with the stars shall withdraw their shining. Yahweh also shall roar out to Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. But Yahweh will be the hope of his people and the strength of the children of Israel. So shall ye know that I am Yahweh, your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. Then shall Jerusalem be holy. And there shall be no strangers pass through her any more. And it shall come to pass in that day that the mountains shall drop down new wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, and all the rivers of Judah shall flow with waters, and a fountain shall come forth of the house of Yahweh, and shall water the valley of Shittim. Egypt shall be desolate, and Edom shall be a desolate wilderness. for the violence against the children of Judah, because they have shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall dwell forever in Jerusalem from generation to generation, for I will cleanse their blood that I have not cleansed, for the Lord dwelleth in Zion.
Okay, first that word, blood. That there are people who actually want to think that this means Yahweh will cleanse bastards, right? But it's not true. It means I will cleanse their bloodshed. The form of the word here is plural. And if you check the actual Hebrew, almost every time that the word appears in a plural, it refers to bloodshed. And very often it's actually translated as bloodshed, even in the King James Version. Don't ask me why they translated it as blood here. It's plural. It's an idiom in Hebrew for bloodshed.
Which word, Bill?
It's the word for blood.
Which verse?
Verse 21. Assemble yourselves and come, all ye heathen. Of course, that's the word for nations, but heathen is assumed because it can't be Israel, right? It has to be the Israel nations, because they're mighty ones are coming down, and the context of this is in the context of the adversaries of Yahweh and of Israel. Let the heathen be wakened and come up to the valley where God judges, for there I sit to judge all the nations round about. Put you in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, get you down. That I believe should be correlated to the harvest of Revelation chapter 14. It's actually been going on now for hundreds of years. Multitudes in the valley of decision. The sun and moon shall be darkened, and the stars shall withdraw their shining. And just like I explained of similar prophecies having to do with Imperial Rome and its fall, this is very similar language. And the sun and moon have to do with worldly governments and administrations. And the stars are the children of Israel shall withdraw their shining. In other words, the people of Yahweh will be oppressed. Worldly governments will fail, and the people of God will be oppressed. And at that point, it seems to be saying that that's when Yahweh shall roar out of Zion. And when he's finished, in verse 17, strangers won't pass through Jerusalem anymore. I think Jerusalem here is also an allegory for the people of Yahweh, for their dwelling places, wherever they are.
User disconnected from your channel.
Egypt and Edom. Egypt might be a reference to captivity here, and Edom to that the eternal enemies of Yahweh who were represented in the world today by Edom. But Judah shall dwell forever in Jerusalem from generation to generation, and I will cleanse their bloodshed that I have not cleansed. Forgive their sins. I don't know if there are questions, but that would be generally how I interpret that chapter.
It's crazy how much more it makes sense through the lens of Christian identity.
Yeah, you know, I was blessed and fortunate enough to never read the prophets without the lens of Christian identity, except for Ezekiel chapters 37 and 38 when I was a kid. And
like, this just sounds like gibberish to like a Judeotard. Like, right.
Yeah, like they can't make any heads or tails of it, right?
Facts.
They just can't.
Well, right, because they think it's all between Arabs and Jews, right?
Yeah.
And even then, they can't make heads or tails of it.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of the reason why they just avoid the entire Old Testament, because the whole thing just sounds goofy to them, right? They don't have any context.
Priests and pastors will tell you that you can't understand this. Oh, you can't understand that.
Yeah, you're stupid.
True. They said that about the Revelation. They're like, we just don't know. It's like, wow.
Yeah. We can know. We do know. It's a revelation. It's something we're supposed to know.
Right.
Irenaeus understood that Revelation was talking about the fall of Rome. Irenaeus understood that in the second century AD. He couldn't foresee the fall of Rome back then, but he understood that's what it meant. At least in part.
Yeah, those guys, they pretty much lived in a similar time to us, because, you know, we can see the fall of the United States and the world imperial order and so forth, and just the world as it is. And they were also living in a time where it was, you know, it was coming, right? It was close. Mm. And I think that they some of them recognized that.
Well, we can only pray that it's closer than they think.
I love that. That calls us to war, kind of. Like, Judeotards would be like, well, Jesus loves everyone. Like,
yep.
I think last week we talked about how when the first coming of the Messiah, they expected a warlord, and they got, like, they got, you know, the story of Jesus as a meek and humble man. And then now we're expecting, or Judeotards are expecting a meek and humble man to come again, but they're going to get the warlord they were asking for in the first place.
Right. That's so crazy. Like, oh, that's so sick. I love it.
Yeah, and he's going to give real definition to that term warlord, because we think of it like on a human level, like, you know, Abraham was sort of a warlord, right? But, you know, we're going to actually find out what that really means.
Yeah. Rule with an iron fist or whatever, rod,
yeah, because
iron
no
rod.
Man has ever actually done that, right? Like really efficiently or proficiently, I guess. But we're going to find out what it actually means to be a warlord. You know?
Praise Yahweh.
So we commence with Amos, or we just sit here silent for the next hour? Or do we just take a short
Amos
nine?
Chapter. I can start Amos chapter one right now.
Yeah, let me preface it first. Okay, Joel and Nahum were contemporaries that both seemed to be very near the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, if not actually in the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, if they didn't actually overlap. Amos is winding back in time to the 8th century BC and ancient Israel. And a lot of Amos is aimed at Israel, not at Judah. He started prophesying, as it says here, in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Uzziah, king of Judah, was the king of Judah for like 50 years almost, I think, from like 790 something BC to roughly about 743, 742 BC. And that's also about the same time that the Assyrians began to come in and take portions of Israel captivity into captivity. And they began taking portions of Israel in the Transjordan region and in Galilee, but they didn't actually reach Samaria until a much later campaign that they must have had like three, four, five campaigns in Israel before they destroyed, or up to the point when they destroyed Samaria in 721 BC. So Amos begins prophesying in sometime before 743 BC. We can't tell how long before. And he continued prophesying until the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. So that's for quite some years. I don't remember exactly how many. And I have to get a light just to find my Bible. But I have a chart in here. He says 2 years before the earthquake, but I don't know if we could really get a grip on the chronology of that earthquake. I'm not sure. I've never tried to do that. I don't think I tried to do that. I could check in my commentary real quick on Amos that I did 10 years ago, but I don't know if I tried to do that then. I'll go try to look while you're reading. At the beginning of 1 Kings, I have a chart. I just want to see when Jeroboam, the son of Joash, that is not really helping me, because it's about the same time frame as Uzziah. Okay, that's when he started prophesying. I'm sorry. So he doesn't tell us how long he prophesied for. He doesn't mention any other kings. Jeroboam, the son of Joash, evidently ended his reign 10 years before Uzziah, around 753 BC. So it appears that Amos might have been started a little earlier than Hosea or Isaiah, if he started that early, which is at least 10 years before the end of the reign of Uzziah. I want to double check that one more time. All these chronologies are different. Yeah, that seems to be about right. I mean, they have Azariah dated 4 years later than, or 3 years later than I do, that he didn't end his reign until 739. I have it at like 743 or 42. But the effect is still the same, that Jeroboam II ended his reign by 753. So they might be a little late on that too, but it's immaterial. That's at least 10 years before the end of the reign of Uzziah. So Amos must have started prophesying before 753 BC. And that's earlier in the reign of Uzziah than the end. Uzziah is going to rule for another 10, 12 years. So I can't, all of these prophets that say they started in the time of Uzziah, which includes Hosea and Isaiah, it's hard to gauge exactly when they started prophesying during the reign of Uzziah. And the reign of Uzziah was very long. It's a little easier here with Amos, because he also says he started in the days of Jeroboam. That's Jeroboam II, the son of Joash. 2 years before the earthquake, I don't think I ever tried to date that earthquake. let me look here in part one of my commentary on Amos and see if I did. I don't remember all of this work. I'm sorry. It's something I did 10 years ago. I can't possibly remember everything. The phrase 2 years before the earthquake may itself be a prophecy, or it may be that these words were written later and in retrospect. However, verse two is a prophetic statement which seems to forebode that earthquake. And that's where it says, and he said, Yahweh will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the habitations of the shepherds shall mourn, and the top of Carmel shall wither. That sounds like it's describing an earthquake, right? That earthquake is mentioned in several places in Amos and is generally believed by archaeologists to have occurred about 750 BC and to have been as high as 8 on the Richter scale. So I don't remember the journal I was quoting at that time. I didn't cite it here. I wasn't as careful 10 years ago as I am today, I guess. But that would 2 years before the earthquake is about when the reign of Jeroboam II ended. So that kind of makes sense. So there, at least we have a rough time of when the earthquake occurred, around 750 BC. And that's just a couple of years after the end of the reign of Jeroboam II. So in any event, Amos began prophesying before 752 BC. And at that time, it's really very likely that no Israelites had been taken into captivity by the Assyrians yet, but that a lot of them were about to be. And we don't read about all, it's just mentioned very vaguely in scripture, that those early captivities. And that's all I really need to say to begin this.
Amos chapter 1. The words of Amos, who was among the herdmen of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Josiah, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. And he said, Yahweh will roar from Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the inhabitations of the shepherds shall mourn, and the top of Carmel shall wither. Thus shall the Lord, for the transgressions of Damascus, and for I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron. But I will send fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the places of Ben-Hadad. I will break also the bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitant from the plain of Aven, and him that holdeth the scepter from the house of Eden. And then people of Syria shall go into captivity into Kir, saith Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh, for the transgressions of Gaza, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they carried away captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. But I will send a fire on them, on the wall of Gaza, which shall devour the places thereof, and I will cut off the inhabitant from Ashdod, and him that holdeth the scepter from Ashkelon, and I will turn mine hand against Ekron, and the remnant of the Philistines shall perish, saith Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh, for the transgressions of Tyrus, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they delivered upon the whole captivity to Edom, and remembered not thy brotherly covenant. Should I end there? Should I read the whole chapter?
Well, finish what it says about Edom.
But I will send a fire on the walls of Tyrus, which shall devour the places thereof. Thus saith the Lord, for the transgressions of Edom, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because he did pursue his brother with the sword, and did cast off all pity. And his anger did tear perpetually, and he kept his wrath forever. But I will send a fire upon Teman, which shall devour the places of Bezra. I'll just end this chapter.
Should I finish it or should I leave it right there?
Go ahead and finish it. It's only 15 verses.
Thus saith Yahweh, for the transgressions of the children of Ammon, and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have ripped up the woman and the child of Gilead, that they might enlarge their border. But I will kindle a fire in the wall of Rabbah, and it shall devour the places thereof with shouting in the day of battle, with a tempest in the day of the whirlwind. And their king shall go into captivity, and he and his princes together, saith the Lord.
Yeah, you know, this seems to be prophetic, because Amos started prophesying before the Assyrians had taken Israel into captivity. In my old notes, I basically stated those captivities had started about 744 BC, which is very plausible. I don't think there were any captivities before that. So Amos seems to be making statements based on what will be, and not what was, but what will be the behavior of the surrounding people when the children of Israel are taken into captivity. So Damascus, even though it's very possible that Damascus had Israelite leaders, that the kings were Israelites.
Microphone activated.
Because David took Damascus, and Damascus had been under the rule of Judah from the time of David, and later under the rule of Israel in the later divided kingdom. But then it became independent of Israel. But it seems that it was no longer subject to Israel from a certain point. And even with that, it was Yahweh that had sent Elijah the prophet to anoint, I believe it was Hazael, the king of Syria, of Damascus. So Israelite prophets were anointing the kings of Damascus in at least that one example. So even though Damascus may have had Israelite kings still at this time, because they seem to come from that same family, the people that are going into captivity from Damascus are still the people of Aram. And the Aramaeans were kindred people to the Hebrews. So there's no problem with that. And there's no problem with the Syrians being subject to Israel for so much time, because mingling with the Syrians isn't really race mixing, right? It's they were just as much Shemites and related to the Hebrews that the Israelites were. There's more to be said on that, but I don't know if I need to say it right now. Jacob was even called a Syrian in Deuteronomy chapter 26, I believe in verse 5, because all of Abraham's kin lived in Padan Aram, which is the plain of Aram. And it seems that the Hebrews and the descendants of Arphaxad may have been mingled with Aram at a very early time. That's what it seems. But there's no documentation except for what we have in Scripture. Devouring the palaces of Ben-Hadad is just devouring the palaces of the kings of Damascus. Gaza was a Philistine city, and so was Ashdod and Ashkelon and Ekron. So the Philistines would also, the Syrians and the Philistines and all the surrounding nations had been under tribute to Assyria, so they would all have had to participate in the Assyrian deportations of the children of Israel. And Amos is prophesying how these surrounding nations would treat the captivity of the children of Israel when that time came, which wasn't long off from this time. It wasn't far off. It would be the next over the next most of it would be over the next 10 to 30 years. Edom is next, and of course the Edomites also took part not only in the as subjects to Assyria in the Israelite captivities, but also as subjects to the Babylonians in the captivities of Jerusalem and Judah, where we see the Edomites had even just been responsible, held responsible in the Psalms of Asaph and in 2nd Esdras for actually destroying the temple. The Babylonian armies destroyed the city, but the Edomites were credited with having destroyed the first temple, the Temple of Solomon. So Teman and Bozrah were places of Edom. And lastly, the Ammonites, the same thing. They would be tribute to the Assyrians, so they would have to contribute soldiers and support to the Assyrian armies. And when they took the Israelites captive, they did these things to them, and for that reason they're going to be punished. Yahweh's saying that when Israel is taken captive, that he's going to punish all these surrounding nations because they took Israel captive. I don't know if there are questions.
What would be a better way, or I guess a more modern way to say 4-4? Because I looked at other translations, it says even 4, but I still don't understand what it means by that.
Which verse is that?
It's repeated. Like in 6, it says, for the transgressions of Gaza, even 4, or 4-4, I will not revoke my judgment. What does that mean, 4-4?
Microphone muted.
And for 4, it's just saying that Gaza is going to transgress 3 times, or even for 4, against his people, the whole captivity. Because they will help take Israelites captive, and here Gaza is going to deliver them to the Edomites. Every time there's a war in the ancient world, all the opposition either got killed or taken into slavery. If you didn't escape, you were either dead or you were bound to be a slave. That was just the way it is in the ancient world. It was always that way. Even right up through Roman times. The Romans would take a city if the city opposed them. Then they would take all the inhabitants of the city into slavery. All the inhabitants, men, women, children, the elderly, would be either killed or enslaved and sold into slavery. So if you were a Syrian or a Judean and you were taken into slavery by the Romans, you would probably end up working on a plantation in Thrace or in southern Italy or somewhere, who knows?
I'm sorry, I gotta step away for a second. My neighbor's at the door. You might have to get somebody to read chapter 2 for you.
Okay, I don't know if there's any more discussion here in chapter 1. Anybody?
So would the Edomites be Nabatahia at this point, or is that later?
No, they were still Edom.
Okay.
But Nabatahians are Ishmaelites. And right. And in fact, Nabatahians are the only Arabs that can actually lay claim to being Ishmaelites. But without a real lie, it appears to me that there's a, I forget exactly how it's spelled, Naboth, maybe, No. It has a different spelling. Nebaioth. N-E-B-A-I-O-T-H. There's a Nebaioth that's the firstborn of Ishmael. And I'm convinced that that's where the word Nabataean comes from.
Makes sense. That's
1 Chronicles 29:1. It's in Genesis also, but I think it's spelled a little differently. Yes. Not really, though. It's in Genesis chapter... Yeah, it is. It's spelled N-E-B-A-J-O-T-H instead of I-O-T-H. Genesis 25:13. Nebaioth is the firstborn of Ishmael. And I believe Nebaioth gave his name to the Nabataeans. And if we see the wives of Esau in Genesis chapter 36, he actually took Nebaioth's sister to wife. So they were always closely linked, the Ishmaelites, the Nabataeans, and the Edomites. I wouldn't doubt if there weren't a lot of Nabataeans among the Edomites moved into Judea. I wouldn't doubt it.
They kind of moved into Petra with the Edomites, didn't they? Isn't that kind of who took over the area?
I believe Petra is Mount Seir. That's my opinion.
That's amazing, honestly. Your channel. So, like, Petra's that, like, city with, like, carvings out of the mountain kind of thing.
There's a lot of carvings in the mountains, yes, but that was common. It's also found in the ruins of Sodom and Gomorrah. And yes, there are ruins of Sodom and Gomorrah. So carving building facades into stone mountains seems to have been common at the time.
That's amazing.
Somewhere on my website, I have a... I got this Judeotard video. Wow, I tried to search it, Chris, again, and it told me I don't have permission. Get out of here. I got this Judeotard video. I got to find it. It's a really amazing video. It's a Judeotard video. There's a lot of prayers and a lot of universalism in it and a lot of bullshit. It has some awful, awesome footage
disconnected from your channel
of the remnants of those cities of the plain in Sodom and Gomorrah.
User entered your channel.
But I don't know how anybody can't watch this video and just think that these places were real. And that the same thing's probably going to happen today. But they don't care. These faggots don't care. I don't remember where I posted the video. It might be on the media side. I don't know, man. I got too much shit. I got way too much material and things posted, and I can't keep track of it anymore. I used to. I guess maybe I'm getting old now. It's all Joe's fault. What's up, Joe? Oop, looks like Joe got a new device. Okay, Joe.
Bill, at a place in the Bible, it talks about the locusts banding together. They come forth in bands. Then it mentions something about, I believe it says, the coney. They build their house in a box. Is that metaphor for anything here?
Arabs.
Yeah.
Build their house in the rocks.
Yeah, I think it was the conies, I believe they said. It's. I'm not on that right now. I can't see it. I didn't know if they might. That might run.
I don't see that here in Amos, unless I missed something.
No, it wasn't in Amos. It was somewhere else. I didn't know if it may be relevant to what we was looking at.
I think it's in an oracle against Edom.
Okay.
Let me see. No. No. Obadiah, though I exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars. That ain't quite what you were saying, though. I'd have to see the passage, but I can't find it.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
I mean, I think there is a passage like you're explaining, but I can't find it.
I believe it's in the same area where it says the ants are a people, somewhere in there.
Ants?
Yeah, it says the ants are a people.
Oh, the conies, here it is, Proverbs chapter 30.
Yeah, there you go, yeah.
The answer of people not strong yet, they prepare for meat in the summer, the conies. That's evidently a badger or some sort of similar animal. Or about a feeble folk, yet they make their houses in the rocks. But I think that's talking about literal animals there.
Okay, yeah.
But I can see what you mean. I mean that in Obadiah, where the Edomites build their nest among the stars, right? They exalt themselves as an eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, seems to be a reference to the same sort of thing, right? That they have their houses in all the high places of the earth. Exalting themselves in that manner. And if you look at the footage of Sodom and Gomorrah, I just posted that link to that video. I found it. It's on my media site. It's really not that long. It's 14 minutes. It's pretty good to watch if you can tolerate the Judeotard crap, which I might sit and cut it out one day. But you'll see that same thing, and that they have in Petra, and I've seen pictures of Petra where they have these facades built into these mountains, and some of them are at ground level, but some of them are up at the top of these mountains. I don't really know how they got in and out of them, but they must have. I don't know who Io's client is, but I'll add him.
Wait, so you said this chapter is about the nations around Israel as they're being taken over?
As Israel is being taken into captivity by the Assyrians.
Right, so a lot of them are given over to Edom.
No, these nations are working, that they're subject nations of the Assyrians.
Right. But Edom so kind of takes
all devoted
the
troops and resources to take Israel into captivity.
Okay.
So they would all share in the booty of the captives.
Right.
So that they would sell them to the highest bidders, right?
Yeah. Would this help to like prove that Edomians lived in Judea when Israel came back from captivity?
No, but Ezekiel chapter 35 helps to prove that.
Okay, right.
And the whole book of Maccabees helps to prove that. And Flavius Josephus and Strabo of Cappadocia. I've cited all those passages. They're all in my Jesus is not a Jew article.
I was wondering, it's like, Herod was worried and all of Jerusalem with him. Like, why?
Yeah, right. And they should have been exulting. They should have been exulting. They should have been happy. They should have felt blessed for an opportunity to see the Messiah. Well, we have enough time for Amos chapter 2. It's only 16 verses. No.
Did we lose the reader?
I'm sorry?
I said, did we lose the reader?
Zeb, what's up? Yeah, I think Jackson, he had a knock at the door or something.
I can do it.
Great. You sound a little tinny, but we could tolerate it.
Yeah, I'm just on the laptop. I'm traveling.
Cool, where are you?
Just over in Richmond.
Okay. Yeah, that's not far.
So chapter 2?
Yes, sir.
Thus saith Yahweh, for 3 transgressions of Moab, and for 4 I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because he burned the bones of the king of Edom into lime. But I will send a fire upon Moab, and it shall devour the palaces of Kiriath, and Moab shall die with tumult, with shouting, and with the sound of the trumpets. And I will cut off the judge from the midst thereof, and will slay all the princes thereof with him, saith Yahweh. Thus saith Yahweh, for 3 transgressions of Judah, and for 4, I will not turn away the punishment thereof, because they have despised the law of Yahweh, and they have not kept his commandments, and their lies caused them to err, after the which their fathers have walked. But I will send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the palaces of Jerusalem. Thus saith Yahweh, for 3 transgressions of Israel, and for 4, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Because they sold the righteous for silver, and the poor for pairs of shoes, that pant after the dust of the earth, on the head of the poor, and turn aside the way of the meek, and a man and his father will go unto the same man to profane my holy name. And they lay themselves down upon clothes laid to pledge by their altar, by every altar, and they drink the wine of the condemned in the house of their God. Yet destroyed I the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and he was strong as the oaks. Yet I destroyed his fruit from above, and his roots from beneath. Also I brought you up from the land of Egypt, and led you 40 years through the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. And I raised up your sons for prophets, and your young men for Nazarites. Is it not even thus? Oh yeah, O children of Israel. Oh yeah, children of Israel, saith Yahweh. But ye gave the Nazarites wine to drink, and commanded the prophets, saying, prophesy not. Behold, I pressed under you as a cart is pressed that is full of sheaves. Therefore the flight shall perish from the swift, and the strong shall not strengthen his force, neither shall the mighty deliver himself. neither shall he stand.
Ye muted, Bill.
That handleth the vow, the bow. And he that is swift of foot shall not deliver him, neither shall he that rideth the horse deliver himself. And he that is courageous among the mighty shall flee away naked in the day, in that day, saith Yahweh.
I'm sorry, Joe, were you getting feedback from me? No? I think Joe might have microphone problems. Amos chapter 2. For three transgressions of Moab and for four, I will not turn away the punishment thereof. Yet, you know, when it says transgressions to these alien nations, it's not that they're transgressing the law and they're being punished on that ground. Rather, it's because they are transgressing themselves against the people of God. And he's going to take vengeance against them for that. That's how I understand this transgressions of these alien nations. They were never given the law.
It's like the judgment of nations, Bill, where the goats are judged for how they treated the sheep.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. That's a good point. Where they burned the kings of the king of Edom into lime. Now, we don't have that episode in scripture. We don't know what it's talking about. And all I can say is this, that until very recently, at least before the time of this prophet, and probably still until the revolt of Edom from Judah, we read in 1 Kings chapter 22, and this was the circumstance since the time of David, when David had subjected, David defeated and made tribute all the Edomites, all of Edom in his day, and they stayed under tribute until they revolted. And they revolted in 2 Kings chapter 8. Edom revolted from under the hand of Judah. 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 20. So this is 1 Kings chapter 22, verse 47. There was no king in Edom. A deputy was king. For all that time, a man of Judah working for the king of Judah would be appointed as the king of Edom to command Edom on behalf of Judah, because Edom was a tribute state to Judah. So there was no king in Edom, a deputy was king. That means the deputy of Judah was the king of Edom, acted, functioned as king of Edom on behalf of Judah. So where it says that he burned the bones of the king of Edom, very likely a man of Judah who was serving, a deputy who was serving as king of Edom. It wasn't an Edomite. But for that, because the king of Moab did that, Yahweh is going to punish Moab. That's one reason. I mean, there are probably many others, right? It says for three transgressions or for four. So there must be other things that Yahweh had against Moab in their relationship with his people.
Race mixing with them.
I'm sorry?
Race mixing because of Balaam.
But, well, I mean, that would also be a transgression, but I don't really know how much that happened. I'm sure it happened to some degree. These Moabites aren't the Israelites in Moab. They're the Moabites in Moab. Moab was preserved south of the Arnon River. That's only took, they were told, they were commanded to preserve Moab south of the Arnon River, but Moab was still subject to Judah from the time of David. All the surrounding nations were subject to Judah from the time of David. And after the divided kingdom, some of them stayed subject to Judah and others were subject to Israel. Until they ended up revolting and declaring their own independence and things like that. So after Moab, it turns to the children of Israel themselves. And Yahweh said he punished Judah because they sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. That's a common complaint throughout Amos. It recurs several times that the people, the wealthier, more powerful people in Israel and Judah were oppressing their own kinsmen for the sake of financial gain. Judah despised the law of Yahweh and have not kept his commandments, and their lies caused them to err. And then Israel sold the righteous for silver and the poor for a pair of shoes. It was probably going on in both places.
That doesn't need to mean that they sold them as slaves, I don't think. I mean, you could invite mongrels in your country to live, and you're basically selling the lives of the poor.
Right.
There are other ways too. Like it doesn't have to mean they're selling them into slavery, does it?
No, but you're either selling them into slavery or you're forcing them into slavery by preferring the outsiders. And even by international trade, you're forcing your own people into slavery.
Yeah, we're in slavery right now.
So he speaks about some of the good things that he did for them, and they still betrayed him. They still were not obedient.
All the rich people could simply just not pay them well.
Yeah, right. That's a form of oppression, to oppress wages. To not pay a workman enough to support himself and his family. And we've been getting kiked since the serpent seduced Eve, right?
If you deny a man his hire, you're also oppressing him. So if you hire an outsider and you deny a fellow Israelite his hire, that's oppressing him.
Absolutely. If you hire them at low wages, that's oppressing them. That's the Epistle of James explains that. Accumulating wealth for yourself and not paying the people who work for you a fair wage, that's oppression. I think we should probably pause here. I mean, two chapters of Daniel. I don't want to rush through this.